Ladies and gentlemen, please do continue your lunch. Mr. Hockey, who we're delighted to have with us here today, has got a speech which he tells me may be a little bit over 20 minutes, so I'm going to try and get this on the road as soon as we can. Before that, just a couple of announcements. For those of you who were looking forward to seeing the EU Trade Commissioner on Thursday, I'm afraid they have an important summit to in Europe and have had to cancel. We do have one other fascinating speaker coming up this month. He's the author Chan Kun Chung, who wrote the, it was a science fiction novel at the time called The Fat Years, about how China is ruling the world. He will be here on the 31st of October, and he'll be talking about how China deals with its awkward squad of dissenters. Back to today's talk. As I say, we're delighted to have Joe Hockey, the member for North Sydney in Australia's Parliament, with us here today. He's also, as you all know, the Shadow Treasurer, has previously been Minister for Financial Services and Regulation, as well as Minister for Small Business and Tourism, and a number of other portfolios. Before entering Parliament, he was a banking and finance lawyer, and if you believe some of the opinion polls, he will very soon be in government again. And if you believe some other opinion polls that I've seen, he may even be the Prime Minister of Australia one day. Mr. Hockey will be speaking to us about Australia's future engagement in the Asian century. I understand that this speech is of a series that he has been giving in the last few months. He's talked about his beliefs in liberty, in opportunity, and in equality. I looked at some of these speeches, and I did notice that there were he talked of the impact of the Arab Spring recently, and how that's inspiration to us all who believe in liberty, and how that may even one day be have its effect felt in China. Without further ado, Mr. Hockey.
Thank you very much, Douglas, and thank you so much for coming out in numbers. I thought there would be a small group, so I'm really honoured that you've come out, and to such an august club. I apologise for my croaky voice. I have the flu. I brought it to Hong Kong, and of course, a few years ago, I wouldn't have got into the through the airport with that, but I apologise in advance. Look, at a recent dinner in Sydney, a close friend of mine introduced me to his travel company employees based in Mumbai, Jakarta, Singapore and Shanghai. And each person is charged with the task of convincing locals in those countries to travel to Australia for their holidays. When I asked the team what they like about Australia, they were emphatic about the clean air, open spaces, good weather and polite people. They said it's a great place to visit, or if they could, even a great place to live. I was struck by a young gentleman at the table, Yash Vora, a 27-year-old from Mumbai. Before coming to Australia the previous week, Yash had never even been in an airport, let alone set foot on a plane. So clearly this two-week visit was a very big experience for him. Even though he had memorised every nightly hotel rate in Australia as part of his job, preparing itineraries for prospective travellers, Yash had never spent a night in a hotel room in Australia or anywhere else for that matter. He knows Cairns from Canberra, and for 4 years had been selling the Australian experience without ever visiting the country. Yash earns around 9,000 Australian dollars a year, about 72,000 Hong Kong dollars, which is considered a reasonable sum of money for a young man in Mumbai, where the minimum wage is set as 110 Indian rupee a day, or about $2.50 Australian or 16 Hong Kong dollars. So this wage pushes Yash into the middle class in India. Even though he's about to enter into an arranged marriage with a woman he has met only four times, Yash comes across as an independent, educated, and confident man. He's a blend of traditionalism and the modern global world in which we live. And Yash is the new and evolving Asia, the middle class. He is knowledgeable, worldly, and technology savvy. However, most importantly, he aspires to have a better quality of life than his parents and aspirations shared by millions across Asia. Much has been written and said recently by many of my parliamentary colleagues and numerous commentators about the awesome growth of Asia and its impact on Australia. Of course, for many years, our relationships in Asia were heavily influenced by our deep and extensive engagement with Japan. This relationship has now broadened, and just as Japan now has China as one of its largest trading partners, we too are adjusting to a new regional dynamic, with China emerging as our largest trading partner and significant bilateral relationships with China, with Hong Kong, Singapore, and other Asian economies. It took us many years to develop a close bond with Japan, but heeding the lessons from this relationship, we know that so much depends on the capacity of individuals to step into the shoes of their newfound business and political partners to fully capitalise on the opportunities these new partnerships can bring. Most contemporary commentary fails to step into the shoes of Yash or his work colleagues that I met, like Vivian Du from Shanghai or Astrid Firmasaya from Jakarta. Yet it is their dreams, their hopes, and their aspirations which give us an insight into Australia's destiny in the region. The emergence of Asia's middle class is generally underestimated because in dollar terms, it still lags a fair way behind Western countries. However, it is the sheer numbers and rapid growth that is most revealing. This is Australia's most significant economic opportunity in the region. The GDP per capita of China has almost doubled in the last 5 years, from over $4,700 US in 2006 to a predicted $8,394 in 2011. According to a Price Waterhouse study, by 2050, the Chinese economy will be roughly 57% larger than the United States, whilst India will be 14% larger. Indonesia will go from being 7% of the size of the US economy to 16% in 2050, and Vietnam from 2% to 10%. Whilst increases in GDP are not evenly spread across the region, the vast populations in Asia's major economies, meaning the emerging middle class, is enormous in terms of sheer volume of people. Within 20 years, Yash, Astrid, and Vivian will be well-established members of the group of some 2.5 billion new middle-class consumers across Asia, seeking a modern first-world lifestyle with all the expectations and demands to match. They will want good jobs for themselves and their children, so they will demand values-based, world-class education facilities and diverse language skills. They will want clean air and clean water, so they will demand safe, consistent and affordable clean energy production backed by a stable energy supplier. They will want mobility, socially and geographically, so they will demand roads and infrastructure able to cope with modern life and access to mass transport that is able to keep pace with their busy lifestyle, including affordable aviation services. They will want immediate access to information, so they'll demand the latest technology combined with connectivity at very rapid speeds. They will want safe, nutritious and affordable food, so they will demand access to top-class agricultural produce and protein with greater diversity and very limited processing. And they will yearn for status, so they will demand luxury goods and access to premium shopping and entertainment. And over time, the discretionary spending of the Asian consumer will rival and then far exceed the level we have today from traditional Western markets in North America and Europe. All the wants of the emerging middle class will become demands because democracy is unstoppable. It's an unstoppable growing force across Asia, whether it is through formal structures or social media. The sheer numbers of the middle class will demand a response to their calls, and governments will give it to them. So how can Australia both accommodate and benefit from this extraordinary geopolitical transition across the region? The starting point on the road to development is always energy and resources, and the foundation stone for much of Asia's economic development is already being provided by Australian businesses. More than 80% of Australia's resource exports currently go to Asia, with 28% to China alone. But the demands for development are also being matched by more recent competing demands for cleaner air, better water, and better environmental management along the way. This underscores a role for Australia to be a source of clean, green, and affordable energy sources. With at least 90 years of known coal reserves at current production rates, Australia will continue to be a reliable supplier of traditional energy. With better research and bilateral investments, such as our $20 million joint venture Clean Coal Technology Program with China, we can find ways to address some of the emerging environmental concerns. We can also offer at least 60 years' supply of gas, which is an alternative to coal and is arguably even more energy efficient. In addition to that, Australia currently holds around 36% of the world's known reserves of low-cost uranium. China and India currently have a small but important nuclear-powered electricity industry and plan to increase their nuclear generating capacity. Australia can and will be a reliable supplier. Australia has agreed to supply China with uranium for its current 14 operating generators and for the more than 25 under construction. However, Australia currently has an outdated policy of refusing to sell uranium to India because it is not a signatory to the United Nations Non-Proliferation Treaty. This has forced India to seek alternative uranium sources in France and Argentina. That policy will change with a change of government in Australia. It is not just good business to sell uranium to India. It is our responsibility as good global citizens to play our part, not just in reducing carbon emissions, but in providing consistent, reliable and affordable energy supplies to our partners. 20 years ago, Japan was our largest trading partner in goods. Today, China is Australia's largest trading partner. Last year, China took $65 billion of Australia's exported goods, with an additional $3 billion to Hong Kong, well ahead of our second largest export recipient, Japan, at $47 billion. Hong Kong was our fifth largest source of foreign investment in Australia. China was our largest supplier of imported goods at $41 billion. This was well ahead of the next largest source of imports, the United States, at $23 billion. This in part reflects the rapid change in consumer spending in Asia and the growth of Asian manufacturing, particularly in China. 3 years ago, consumer spending in developing Asia reached $4.3 trillion, which was about a third of private consumption in the OECD. Within 20 years, this is predicted to grow to 43% of global consumption. In a short time, China alone will account for 20% of the world's luxury goods sold. Whilst Australia will remain a niche supplier of some consumer goods like cars, household appliances and clothing, our biggest opportunity for relationship growth is in the services sector. Last year, Asian countries took 44% of Australia's services exports. China was our largest export partner, taking over 10% of our services exports and passing the United States for the first time. Services exports to China are predominantly for travel, for both business and leisure. And these are astounding figures for those that are familiar with Australia. In 1991, 16,500 Chinese visitors came to Australia. Over the last 12 months, that grew to more than 454,000, plus a further 164,000 from Hong Kong. This will grow to over 900,000 visitors from China in 2020. When I was tourism minister in 2000 and visited Beijing, I was asked by the government how many visitors could Australia accommodate. That's a rather intimidating question from a country with 1.3 billion people. After lengthy discussions with Chairman He, the more important question became obvious. How many Chinese visitors can Australia properly cater for? We're not a high volume destination. We cannot cater for 6 million Chinese visitors a year, which is our current total visitor numbers, especially if they all go to Bondi Beach. We want to make sure that we give our visitors a great experience in Australia, so they must be greeted by hosts who speak their language, provide experiences that meet their needs, and give them a reason to come back again and again. Even better, once they get to know Australia, they may well be inclined to send their children over for part of their education. They may be willing to purchase medical and other services from us in a safe and professional environment. And they'll be inclined to drink our wines, eat our produce, consume our energy. This is our big opportunity. The Asian culture quite rightly puts a very comprehensive education at the heart of success. Asian families see education as the passport to reward and a prosperous life. Vivian, the travel consultant from Shanghai, reminded me of this when she expressed a desire to send her children to an Australian university. This year alone, there are over 332,000 long-term foreign students studying in Australia, with over 200,000 hailing from Asia. These are not the children of elite families. Overwhelmingly Chinese, Indian and Indonesian students are choosing to study on campus in Australia rather than study the same courses online. Top Australian executives operating in Hong Kong and China tell me that Chinese students receiving tertiary qualifications from Australian universities while living in Australia are highly regarded when they return home because of their language and interpersonal skills. Their international experience gives them the edge with the large firms operating in the new world. We must, however, take an even more aggressive approach to our development as an education hub for Asia and the Pacific. It is the obvious basis for successful, enduring engagement with our region. For example, I'm particularly pleased with the emerging growth of campuses across northern Australia in Darwin, Townsville, Cairns and Broome. Institutions like the University of Notre Dame are taking advantage of state government incentives to expand their campuses in towns like Broome. Others like James Cook University, which has 5,600 international students, not only growing domestically in Cairns and Townsville, but they have only over 2,500 students at their campuses in Singapore and Beijing. Our government has a role to play in facilitating greater growth in this area. For a city like Cairns, education exports are a major future source of job and investment growth. Vitally, international students keep the tourism planes coming. Our education relationship with Asia must extend beyond students attending Australian schools and universities. Unfortunately, Australia only has 1,680 students in the entire Asian region. It's not good enough. Australian schools and universities must start developing stronger facilitation links in the region. Australian students should also seek significant opportunities to study across Asia. Many campuses across Asia resist the opportunity to accept foreign students. This must change. Bilateral agreements between educational institutions would be of long-term benefit to the region. Moreover, government facilitation of these relationships should be a priority. The chance to experience different culture, language, and political environments should be seen as a major asset by global employers. Australia's engagement with Asia must start in primary school. Our education system does not sell the merits of learning and becoming fluent in an Asian language. Over 300 students, only 300 students in Australia of non-Chinese heritage studied Mandarin in year 12. While many students start off learning languages in primary school, there is not enough incentive to continue these subjects when the studies become optional. So now is the time for curriculum change to make that happen. Healthcare is another area where Australia could more closely engage with Asia. Our cradle-to-grave universal healthcare system is the envy of many nations, and we have some of the best doctors, best hospitals, and best administrators. And we are renowned for medical research, in particular, IVF research, cervical cancer vaccines, cochlear implants are all examples of our prowess. We have no shortage of talent to develop medicines, vaccines, and medical equipment. However, we're not too good at commercialising these innovations. Commercialisation that does occur often has limited capital. So whilst Australian doctors are already practising across the region, their work is actually quite limited to international hospitals. As living standards improve across Asia, better quality healthcare will be demanded by a growing middle class. They'll want better equipment, better hospitals, and better preventative health strategies. we should not be afraid of selling Australia as a location for highly specialised medical procedures, from dental care to complex surgery. In fact, there is a business in my electorate that specialises on cosmetic surgery for Asian customers. We also have very sophisticated allied health services available. Medical tourism is a rapidly growing multi-billion dollar industry, and just as education has proven a massive growth sector to Australia's domestic advantage, so too will medical services grow. Like many other service areas, Australians must get their heads around the concept of medical procedures as an export opportunity. As many of you know, Australia's financial services industry also offers opportunities. Money is mobile and fungible, and Australia has much to offer, from simple bank accounts to complex financial products. Importantly, we have particular expertise in funds management. And the reliance on the nature and propensity of Asian consumers to save rather than spend means there are significant funds available to be invested. Australian banks already operate in Asia with innovative banking products. And a good example of this is ANZ's involvement in Cambodia with the Royal Bank. About 500,000 Cambodians have bank accounts. However, ANZ had identified that many people do not have accounts, but a growing number have mobile phones. So now a customer with an ANZ account can send money by sending a text message. When enough credit has been built up, their family members can then pick up their cash at over 500 Cash Express outlets across the country. By default, it allows anyone with a mobile phone to have a de facto bank account without the paperwork. There are roughly 200,000 Cambodians now using this ANZ system. Apart from innovative developments at a transactional level, we can offer high-end financial services. And this is a stunning figure, the number of high net worth individuals in Indonesia, that is individuals with more than $1 million in investable assets, excluding property, will almost triple by 2015 to nearly 100,000. And these wealthy Indonesians will hold close to $500 billion worth of wealth, which is the fastest rise in Asia. So this is a tremendous opportunity for Australia to develop and provide a high standard range of products and services. Potentially, the marketing of Islamic banking and finance products has the capacity to increase the access to capital of all Australians and the region. However, there remain regulatory obstacles, such as the double taxation. The UK's financial regulator, the FSA, has summarised their approach to Islamic banking as no obstacles but no special favours. In Australia, we should not treat Islamic banking differently or preferentially, but we should be mindful of making Australia an attractive market for all types of financial services, provided they are in line with Australia's high standards. One of the areas where we have delivered world-class performance is in the area of regulatory supervision. Now, I know, and this is a difficult thing to put in a speech, to many Australians this may seem a little odd. Regulation is often viewed as an impediment to private sector activity and economic growth rather than a positive attribute. However, it's important to recognise the role that a strong and well-structured regulatory environment can play in ensuring the excesses of private sector behaviour are avoided and the optimum social outcomes are achieved. Hong Kong performs well in this area, but business people tell me that the red tape burden in China and India can be problematic. One of the contributors to Australia's robust economic performance during the global troubles of the past 4 years was the resilience of our financial system and the strong performance of our banks. This is widely recognised. The resilience is not accidental. It reflects Australia's strong prudential framework, which largely reflects the financial reforms of the previous coalition government in which I was a member. So the targeted regulatory structure in Australia worked well and ensured we were well capitalised, had adequate liquidity and did not build up excessive exposures. The quality of the professional regulators was of key importance. We also have a strong record of reform in the regulation of financial services, with a progressive unification and simplification of financial products and financial service providers. This has allowed strong growth in the provision of financial services and products to non-professional investors, such as households and small businesses. In fact, Australia has some of the most innovative financial products in the world. So what this means is that financial services now comprise 10% of Australia's gross domestic product. Now, it might surprise you, but this is the largest area of GDP held by one sector in Australia, larger than mining, larger than manufacturing, larger than agriculture. Of course, other areas of regulation and the broader role of our legal system represent further opportunities for trade. In fact, here in Hong Kong, I keep running into Australian lawyers and judges. Previously, they were probably driving taxis around Melbourne and Sydney, but maybe not the judges. Could be in trouble for that. Clearly, within the right regulatory system, we have much to gain through legal services exports. While some sectors of the Australian economy, from agriculture to tourism, have already engaged with Asia, I believe we can do more to prepare regional Australia for the challenges that lie ahead. The Australian arc of emerging prosperity reaches across northern Australia, from North Queensland through the rugged Northern Territory to the Pilbara, where it was just a few days ago in Western Australia. We have an opportunity to send a message of engagement with our broader region by creating specialist regions. The Northwest should be the centre of our sphere of opportunity in the Indian Ocean. Our opportunity is to use the mineral and energy wealth of the Northwest to provide a clean, sustainable energy source for Asia through the export of natural gas, and to resource the industrialisation of rapidly developing economies through the export of iron ore and other metals. Darwin should be the centre of our sphere of mutual obligation with Asia. We share common goals in fighting global terrorism, halting people smuggling, and providing economic and social stability. Far North Queensland should be the hub of fulfilling our sphere of responsibility in the Pacific Rim. We should work with our Pacific neighbours to ensure they have the skills and capacity to underpin a robust economic future and an emphasis on poverty reduction. Over time, these specialist regions should be part of a more integrated plan for regional engagement. Health, education and tourism services, together with resource and energy supply, represent hub opportunities for growth in northern Australia. If the Australian government needs to provide taxation or funding incentives for the northern development, then this should be properly considered. The Australian government has commissioned a white paper on our regional engagement. The northern hub approach is worthy of further examination. So, ladies and gentlemen, the key to our relationship with our region is that Australia must be a consistent, reliable and stable business partner. We should be the blue chip stock of our time zone. We will never be the biggest, but we must strive to be the best and most trustworthy. We must be a predictable friend and a training partner. Unfortunately, this has been compromised from time to time by our current government. The recent ban on live cattle exports to Indonesia, failed detention centres in East Timor and the failed Malaysia people swap are classic examples. But the good news is I want to change that by changing the government. Nevertheless, today I haven't even touched on the growing opportunities to capitalise on Asian middle-class demand in agricultural production, media services, gaming, housing and architecture, the arts and sport. There is so much to do as those 2.5 billion middle-class Asians emerge over the next 20 years. The Asian resurgence is underway. This is an opportunity for Australia rather than a threat. And the fact that Yash and Astrid and Vivian have all gone from relative poverty to middle class in less than a generation shows that we live in a rapidly changing world. And the pace of this change will not slow. We must not be hesitant in our engagement. Opportunity for the diverse people of Asia is not just a dream, it's a reality. And our responsibility is to help as many people as possible realise that reality and ensure that we are part of the success story of Asia over the century ahead. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thanks very much, Joe. And we have some time for questions, and I very much encourage you to put some questions to our guest today in the corner over there. Thank you.
Hi, thank you very much for that speech. I completely agree with the whole Asian consumption story. It's going to be a very exciting couple of decades. My question is, while that's a massive opportunity, and Australia has a huge advantage when it comes to extractive industries like the mining and the energy, How does Australia compete in all the other areas where you are actually quite a high-cost nation? For example, Australia's minimum wage is twice that of the US's. And what's your view, and do you see any changes in the future if you do become the standing government?
Well, is that it? I can't hear myself.
Yeah, that's it.
Sorry. My ears are blocked, but hopefully you can hear me. Well, no one fell overboard, so hopefully. The minimum wage issue, look, Australia will not be able to compete directly with China or Vietnam or a number of other countries when it comes to mass production of goods. We need to be innovative at the cutting edge. We need to use innovation in design and become a niche specialist, as well as having a manufacturing sector that addresses many of our domestic needs. I was in the Pilbara last week, and 2 weeks ago, which the development there is quite extraordinary. And they were building a new gas plant called Pluto, and it's $16 billion to build this gas plant, and there are five others adjoining it already, and there's probably numerous more to be built. The gas plant is assembled, it's built in Thailand, along a beach. And they break it into modules, and they have thousands of welders and engineers along this beach in Thailand that is churning out these gas processing plants. And they lift it up, put it on a ship, and it's probably about 8 or 9 stories high, and then they bring it to the Pilbara, roll it off the ship, put it in place. And if you were to say that Australia could compete with that, all of the people building these plants, the owners of them, are saying, we can't. That's not our niche. That's not our skill. There is a production line along a massive beach in Thailand. And from my perspective, it reminded me that our skills are in some other areas. And we've got to capitalise on those skills, which is effectively what I'm saying today. I'm not saying abandon manufacturing in Australia or abandon the export of some cars from Australia. I'm saying let's be fair dinkum about the fact that we are not going to produce cars cheaper than India or China, where there is a massive growth, massive, phenomenal growth in car demand. Let's just focus on what we are good at and export to this consumer class. Yeah. We're competing with the United States. Look, the United States was struggling to compete with China. And what's had an impact to the United States on the minimum wage, we are not going to reduce the minimum wage in Australia. We are not going to do it. There is no need to do it because we currently have an unemployment rate of 5.2%. And we have export, and 70% of our economy is services. 70%. So we actually have a greater opportunity for export. The big challenge for us is our high dollar, and I see us having a high dollar for an extensive period of time. That's difficult because we have a floating dollar, and as many of you might be aware, the Australian dollar is one of the most liquid currencies in the world, heavily traded. And that is, I know the dollar is quite a contentious issue here in Hong Kong. Your currency.
Francis, question.
Your dollar.
Francis Moriarty, FCC board. Observation question. Observation is that I think your statistics of 100,000 Indonesians possessing $50 billion worth of investable...
$500 billion.
$500 billion. Oh, even better. $500 billion investable, not including real estate, is a powerful statistical prognosticator of future social unrest. That's just the observation. The question is completely different. You talk about Australian judges and lawyers. I'll pass on a comment there. But we have a lot of Australian academics in Hong Kong and elsewhere around Asia. Mm. And when you ask them why they're teaching here and not in Australia, they say because the salaries are too low. Australia just can't compete with salaries elsewhere. So how are you going to turn Australia into this educational hub that's going to bring in students from everywhere if you've got professors leaving and going elsewhere because the salaries are too low?
I think Australian universities have been very slow to have industrial relations reform. They've been more focused on tenure than they have on competence. And that is changing as the market for students is increasing and the competition between the universities is increasing.
That's going to raise pay?
That will inevitably raise pay for good academics.
And on the observation, any comment on the observation?
I was struck by meeting an American woman some years ago who introduced me to her daughter. And she said to me, she traveled a long way to introduce her daughter to me. And I said, why did you come all this distance? And she said, because I know that I'll never have the capacity to get to Australia, but I want my daughter to understand Australia and get there. Now, it reminded me of the fact that America, even with its poverty, and it does have considerable poverty, most Americans believe that even if they're not the richest person in America, they can one day be the richest person. This is hugely challenging for the rest of the world, because the internet is driving, social media is driving this aspiration, which is fantastic. And when people cannot see a path to get their aspirations delivered, that's when they rebel. And this is what's fueled the Arab Spring. They see, their leaders in big palaces with huge cars and private planes, and they say, I can't get there. Therefore, they are without hope. And the secret and the challenge, particularly for China, but also for India, is every single person in your country must have the capacity to one day be the richest person in that country, or to be the leader of that country. Because if you take that away, that hope that one day they could get there, then they will rebel. They will rebel. And with great credit to the current Indonesian government, they are locking in democracy with a nation with 200 million people, and the aspirations of the poorest people need to be able to be met by democracy. And this is a challenge for China. When I was there last, they celebrated X years, I don't know how many, 20 years of Ferrari or something in China. And I thought to myself, that is so out of reach for most people in China. But if the Chinese people can't aspire one day to own a Ferrari, then that's when it all ends in tears. And they have to know how to get there. It's possible, but this is a secret to democracy, whether it be actual legislated democracy or social media democracy. People have to believe that they can get there.
Could you introduce yourself, sir? Yes, the lady. Could you introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Christine McGee,
Orientation. You just need to point it at your mouth, Christine.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Chris, thank you. I've been here for 20 years. I'm an Aussie. And my question goes back to tourism. I would like to know if, when you're in government or while you're in opposition, if you have actually considered some kind of serial structural reform about the tourism industry. I mean, I go regularly to Australia, and I come from Orange, and a motel in Orange costs $220 a night, okay? You can practically stay in the Mandarin Oriental on budget, for that. Everywhere you go in Australia for the last 20 years, we've just been paying so much money for this sector that seems to be so fragmented and uncoordinated. And I was in Australia 2 weeks ago, and I read this story in the Sydney Morning Herald. You said, actually, since the Olympics, the tourism numbers are actually declining, okay? I don't know if anyone else saw that story, but it was quite a detailed story.
Yeah.
And there are several people who are critics of the current policy, particularly the advertising that's been spent recently. So, do you agree that there are problems with the Australian tourism where it's structured? Is the opposition fully understand the impact of the high Australian dollar? And thirdly, what can you do about it?
Well, firstly, I accept blame for restructuring the tourism industry when I was tourism minister. And I gave it an extra $250 million and increased its marketing budget, delivered a white paper, and we abolish the Australian Tourist Commission, see Australia created Tourism Australia and research and da-da-da. The bottom line is this, Australia is not a low-cost, you know, high-volume destination. It's not. The airfare, the starting point is the airfare is going to be more expensive than flying from here to Singapore. Just on yield, it might please you to know that I paid for a really ordinary three-bedroom, three-star motel in the Pilbara more each night than I'm paying at the Grand Hyatt in Hong Kong. And why? Because there's no other hotels at the Pilbara. Or in Gladstone, I paid $300 for a B&B, which really upset me. So I understand what you're saying. The problem, part of these infrastructure, but the cost of real estate. Look, I mean, Hong Kong's got its challenges with hotel rooms, I must say, and you are going to see an explosion in the cost of hotel rooms here in Hong Kong because there's a lack of supply. And it's the same in Australia. But part of the problem is in Australia, we are not, you know, it's cheaper. There's a shortage of accommodation. We're quite similar to Hong Kong in this regard. There's a shortage of accommodation. So supply is not meeting demand, even in a damn big continent. And the net impact is there's been too many conversions of hotels to apartments. There's no simple answer. As for the Aussie dollar, what it does is reinforce the fact that we are a yield-based destination, not a high-volume destination. We cannot compete. A mate of mine is selling seven nights in Thailand, seven nights for two people, including breakfast, seven nights for $259 Australian. Right? Sorry, guys, we can't compete. We're not going to compete. We're not going to compete with that sort of cost. And that's in Phuket. And major hotel in Thailand, $350 for seven nights. I mean, come on. We're not going to produce mass-produced goods. That is not our game. Let's be fair dinkum about it. We cannot out-manufacture China. We can be, you know, look for innovation and come up with new niche products like cochlear implants and a range of things, but we cannot. We're not a mass producer that can compete even in tourism.
You've just got a couple of minutes for one last question. There are two ladies there, maybe.
I'll have shorter answers. Can I?
Okay, we'll take both of them.
Yeah.
Just very quickly.
I don't want to. So I've been. That's okay, it's working. Just speak into it. Yep. Yep.
There, hello. Alison Howarth West is my name. And
hello, Oh, yes.
Yeah, there you go. And having been a stakeholder in the tourism industry when Mr. Hockey was the minister, I can say that he did a great job. So well done on your reform. Thank you very much. We certainly.
I'll send you flowers later.
Yeah, good on you. Yeah. And as a accommodation provider at that time and hospitality provider, I can tell you one of the greatest challenges for the tourism industry in Australia are labour costs and other costs. So you just, apart from scarcity, you actually have a great deal of difficulty in controlling room rates and other things. But the actual question or comment that I wanted to raise was about education. And having formerly been on actually an advisory board for one of the universities in Sydney, it's a sort of a question close to my heart because the attraction of attracting foreign students and the contribution, financial contribution and enrichment that can provide to the universities is very good. And, you know, I'm all for it. But in addition to that, my concern, having children at schools in Hong Kong and observing firsthand the strength of the commitment to academics in Asia, what is your view on Australia and the, I guess the Liberal Party or your view on how we should be approaching trying to increase the proportion of kids that go to university and tertiary, various types of tertiary education?
Well, look, there has been a significant increase in investment by a number of universities in Australia in infrastructure that accommodates foreign students or outside students. I want to see that increase, and as I flagged, I'd like to see that increase in regional areas across the north. I mean, James Cook University is a pioneer in medical research in exotic diseases, and right on the Barrier Reef. I'd like to see that sort of niche product grow. I would like to facilitate, however I can, Australian universities being far more aggressive in the Asian region. Without diminishing the Australian quality. Yeah.
Basically, Australia becoming less competitive in this region because everybody else is becoming more
independent. Yeah.
And
unfortunately,
our population
is
being a smart nation.
Yeah, I agree. I couldn't agree more. Australians need to, if we can get, the number of university places is now uncapped for Australians. It's uncapped. So, they've just got to compete. I'm not into the nanny state. I mean, I want to provide, my simple philosophical view is this. We have an obligation as a government to get people to the starting line. And after the gun goes, there will be some people that will run faster than others. So be it. So be it. I don't believe in handicapping the fastest runner to bring them back to the field. I want my children to grow as tall as they can, to be as successful as they can, and my job is to facilitate every opportunity in the world for them, but they will learn. And, therefore I'm not for the nanny state.
Joe, we're actually at 2 o'clock. I know you said you'd take one final question. With everyone's indulgence, there was a lady who already wanted to ask a question.
There's a gentleman out there too.
If we could just take this one final question, Joe, maybe if you'd like to, some people would like to approach you later with a few
sure.
other questions. Just the final question then for this afternoon.
I feel really guilty now.
No,
I
can't be guilty.
I'm a bit interested in exploring your concept of democracy and saying that an aspiration of a democratic society is one where people aspire to be the richest. I've been in Hong Kong 8 years. I work in the education sector. And the average conversation that I have with aspiring Hong Kong people is access to participation in public life, access to information,
yep.
diminishing hierarchies. They're not interested in being the richest. They want to participate and they want to say in how their society evolves. And I don't know many Australians that have ever talked about being the richest. I get the analogy with America. I get and value that notion that you can be what you want. But I don't think that's an Australian value the most. And I would like to think a yep. leader also, sorry, to explore
yeah, yeah,
that
yeah.
with Indonesia or talk and talking about Indonesia's impressive move towards democracy and putting in those systems and those checklist things that do define a democracy, there's still all of that hidden stuff that has to be ironed out to make a place authentically democratic. We see this in Europe when we see Eastern Bloc countries defaulting because you can tick all the things on a checklist and say democratic and wonderful, but underneath it all there are the hidden economies and the untransparent democratic process or untransparent governing processes, and so democracy to me is more
sure.
about people.
Yeah. No, I think you. Firstly, to be fair, I don't think it's the Eastern Bloc countries that are about to default. I think it's more the home of democracy. The question or the observation from Francis was about the rich in Indonesia. That's why I referred to the rich and making money and so on. It is about hope. It has to be about hope. And look, my father came from Palestine. And back in 1998, I took him back to Palestine and he was born in Bethlehem. And we walked around the refugee camps in Gaza and so on. And apart from thinking there but for the grace of God, could I have been, what struck me was that only just after 50 years got running water, and some didn't even have sewage, and they had electricity. And there would be three generations of men sitting in a room watching TV because they had nothing else to do. There was nothing else they could do. And they were watching TV, and I'm looking at them as they were watching Dynasty and all these other, you know, trash American shows. And they were sitting there, and I knew what was going through their minds. This is something they could never have. The youngest one would look there and look at his father and his grandfather. This is mainly the men. They'd look and they'd say, I can never have that. I could end up like my father and my grandfather here. And what happens when they've got no hope? They've got, you know, a mufti down the road that is telling them, if you blow yourself up, you can go to paradise. That's the way for us to get what you see. And we underestimate that in the West. We underestimate how important it is for people to have dreams and to be able to achieve their dreams. We underestimate it. We take it for granted. So I'm not just talking about making money. I'm talking about being the fastest runner in the world. I'm talking about being the best academic, about pioneering research. I'm talking about the things that give people hope that their dreams can come true. That is what is going to drive democracy. It is about people saying enough. They can now vent their views through Twitter and Facebook and other social networks, and they can coordinate themselves as an army of individuals because they no longer accept that there's something in this world they cannot have. And whoever the impediments are, they will get rid of them. That's why some governments seek to control the internet and mobile phones. That's why they try to censor people, because they know that the greatest threat to authoritarian rule is freedom of speech. And all I say is that in a world where there is extreme wealth and extreme luxury, the only thing that will placate the great masses that will never have access to it, never see it, is the hope that one day, if they cannot get there, then their children can. And that's why I believe the march towards democracy is unstoppable.
Mr. Hockey, thank you so much for coming here. And giving that powerful, those powerful comments in a place where we value freedom of speech above anything
Absolutely,
else.
You do.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've already joined me in thanking Mr. Hockey. I'm sure he's got a few minutes if some of you would like to ask some of the questions I haven't allowed you to ask. My apologies for that. Thank you again for coming. Thank you, Joe.
Thanks very much. Thanks.
I think we're going to take a quick final photo and also get
something. Great. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, no.